Welcome to the Digital Leaders Podcast, Season 3. I'm Robin Knowles, and I'm excited to be back for my second season as your host of the Digital Leaders Podcast. In our third season, you'll be joining me each week to meet a digital leader from a particular sector who is making a real impact in their field of expertise. They'll each join us in a conversation that helps us find out more about them, what makes them tick, and what their views are on leading in our digital age. Today's guest is Daniel Korski, CBE. Daniel was a special advisor to UK Prime Minister David Cameron and is now co-founder and CEO of Public, a venture capitalist firm focused on helping technology startups transform our public services. Hello, Daniel. Great to have you on the Digital Leaders Podcast.
Hi. Great to be here.
Before we find out a bit more about you, can you tell me a bit more about Public and what it does?
Absolutely. So Public is the venture firm that I've co-founded with Alex Caballo with a vision of bringing the best technology into the public sector. One of the concerns that I had working in government was that what every other sector, from retail to advertising, was being totally transformed by new technologies. And often those new technologies were being brought into the market by new companies. The public sector was suffering from a dearth of innovation and a construct in the market, which meant that a lot of the larger vendors who've been supplying government for years and years were continuing to do so. And Public was created to support companies, startups, product-led startups, that wanted to transform public services. And what we do is we run an accelerator program called GovStart. We started in the UK and scaled that in Germany and France, where we take existing startups through a process of product development, product market fit, BD strategy, and so on. But we also build our own companies, studio staff from scratch when we think we've got a good idea, understand where there's a gap in the market. And then we've invested in companies off our balance sheet, and run a series of events to support companies, principally our GovTech Summit in Paris, which is a large gathering co-hosted with the French president of the European GovTech ecosystem. And most recently, of course, our public hall, our co-working space, which we've launched in collaboration with Huckletree in the middle of Whitehall in order to bring the startups as close as possible to the potential public buyers. So a lot of different things, but ultimately Public is a venture business focused on backing startups that want to transform public services.
And have you had early success? I mean, how long has it been going now?
So we've been at it for 3 years. And I always love this question because I think, you know, gosh, there's so many different ways to define success. When I started out with our first step, which was the accelerator, you know, I defined success at the time as having people apply to the accelerator. And when we ended up with 140 applications from 140 different companies, for the first cohort of the accelerator, I thought that was a massive success. But of course, the moment that you succeed in attracting attention, selecting, persuading companies to come on side, you then have to move to another measure of success, which is to ensure that the companies actually benefit from the experience, get what they want out of it. And ultimately, then you have to move to a new set of criteria, which is, and how does that all make business sense for us? So from the sort of early days of launching Public, and in particular our GovStart Accelerator program, getting people interested, offering them an experience that they thought was worthwhile parting with equity for, and ultimately now getting, you know, some financial returns. I have to say that Public, you know, is successful. And while, of course, you know, the goalposts are always moving, you always think about the next thing. We've had, you know, four different exits. The last one at a very favorable multiple. And that sort of reinforced the model and reinforces the success, which then attracts more people. So it's been great so far.
You mentioned Le Summit in Paris, which I think is next week or the week after. That just seems, as an organizer of summits and gatherings ourselves, that just seems extraordinarily successful. Is there a particular thing that has kind of given that such early success last year?
Well, I think I was blessed by my total ignorance. And but what I mean by that is my total ignorance of the events business, of how hard it is to build a successful event, to attract speakers, to attract sponsors, to attract audiences. So I literally had no idea how difficult it was going to be. And in a way, I think we were blessed by it because we sort of just trundled ahead and we just forced everybody in the business to drop what they were doing, whether they were working on technology products or research reports or the accelerator or whatever they were doing, and just threw everybody at the summit. And it created a sort of happy and ultimately successful amateurishness. So I think that energy that we brought to it, I think, was part of the success. The fact that we didn't really know that you can't expect the Canadian Prime Minister and the French President and the UN Secretary General to come and speak at your first event meant that we were naive enough to ask them to come. And lo and behold, that they did. I also think in fairness, we were, you know, lucky insofar as we brought something to the market that didn't really exist before. You know, Victor Hugo, the French writer, said it's very hard to stop an idea whose time has come. And I think we came along at a time with an idea, namely that GovTech ought to be seen as a separate sector and that Europe has a well-developed market and has an opportunity to further that market even still. And I think that all came together last year at the right time, which I think also bred a lot of the success on the summit. Now, of course, we've got that perennial second album challenge. You know, well, these guys came out of the starting gates. That was an amazing first album. Can they really do it the second time? And as you say, it's in a couple of weeks, and I'm super excited about the program. We've announced some of our speakers, not least the Estonian president, given how incredibly digitally advanced Estonia is. It's very exciting to hear from her. But in our sort of true fashion, there'll be startups and officials and investors all interested in technology that transforms public services and from across Europe.
Fantastic. It's a great success. And I love the Victor Hugo quote. I think a lot of us probably in digital transformation it's a good way of explaining how this sort of movement is just growing and moving and doesn't seem to be stoppable by the blockers. In the system.
I thought what was really exciting, and I think ultimately after the dust has settled and I'd seen enough pictures of luminaries on stage, I think the thing that really made me and the team excited about what we've done was when startups, when founders came to us and said, thank you so much for doing that. I feel that I've been toiling in an undescribed, unnamed sector. And the summit created a sense that we were part of something bigger and that at the highest levels of government, ultimately the most senior buyers, were appreciative of what we were doing, thought we were part of something important, and were sending an important signal to policymakers and buyers further down the system. So that was hugely exciting. And I remember one Irish startup who came to me and said, I just want to thank you. And you know, he had almost tears in his eyes. And he said, I've been hoping to meet this one particular official, and I've not had a chance to meet with her just to explain, you know, how we're building our technology and the problems we think we can solve. And suddenly, you know, I get invited to the GovTech Summit, and you invite me to speak on a panel, and who sits next to me on the panel, if not the official that I was hoping to speak to? And I just thought at that moment, wow, if we can do that 1,000 times over, 2,000 times over at the summit, then you know, it'll be a great success and we'll have done a really good thing.
And I think it plays into this growing space of the value of peer-to-peer networking, this sort of bringing people together at a particular level and letting them share and sort of counting the bumps as people bumping into each other in a serendipitous way and sort of moving things forward. As you know, as your delegate was saying, in a way which, you know, otherwise would probably take another 2 years to make happen.
Yeah, the sort of organized serendipity of these events, which also presents a real problem, because when you go out to build an event, and Robin, you know this far better than I, you know, the things that get sponsors excited and journalists writing about the event is all the formal stuff. You know, who's speaking at this panel, who's a keynote speaker. And at the same time, as those are the things that you need to drive interest and sponsors, it isn't actually the most valuable thing that happens. The most valuable thing that happens is over the coffee breaks between the panels, the conversations people have when they're smoking outside or standing in the bars at the end of the day. And yet it's very hard to organize only for that. So there's that careful balance to be had.
Yeah, totally right. So I want to delve a bit into your past. So we know you're a special advisor at Number 10, and you're now an entrepreneur with your startup, which is rapidly becoming much more than the startup. But tell us about your journey and the inspirations and beliefs that have led you to where you are now.
I always tell young people who come and ask for career advice that you should go and do things that you find really interesting. And if you are lucky enough to end up doing things that you find really interesting, you're likely to be better at them than if you're doing things that you don't find interesting. And I was never very strategic about what I wanted to go and do. I actually knew in part what I didn't want to do. And earlier in my career, what I did not want to do was to go into the family business. I did not want to work in commerce. And the idea of setting up a business was frankly not something I'd even contemplated. So the early part of my career, when I was a diplomat, when I worked in the UN, when I set up a think tank, when I was a policy advisor in government, was in a way a response to what I didn't want to do. But I always ended up doing things that were really interesting. When people invited me to go and try out things, go to new countries, take on new jobs, I always sort of asked myself whether I thought it'd be interesting. And I let that in. It's made for a fascinating, exciting, but a little bit of a peripatetic, non-linear career. There are then a couple of things that sort of run through my career, and a real interest in public services and helping to create, you know, a better world. I started out working for the UN in war-torn former Yugoslavia. My career took me to places like Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Libya, as well as Washington and Brussels. But the early part of my career that I spent in a lot of these post-war, post-conflict zones were really important years for me, because they allowed me to sort of bring, you know, my energy and what intelligence and skills I have to help better people who were really in the worst of straits. And I think that's been a constant refrain in my life. You know, I want to work to improve public services because I want to create, you know, I want to better the lot of those who aren't as fortunate as I've been. And so I started doing that in a very particular context. And then I moved from the foreign policy side to the domestic policy side. And ultimately, I've now moved out of government, but focusing on what I think is absolutely critical to the improvement of public services future, namely the nature of the technologies we're going to improve, we're going to use inside public services. So that there is a sort of strand running through my career of seeking out the things that I find interesting. And the second strand is this strand of seeking to help deliver public services for those who are less fortunate than I've been.
You'll have to forgive this question, but for those of us that haven't worked at Number 10, what is that like? Is it empowering, frustrating, fraught with a sense of terrible responsibility, or great fun, or all of the above?
It's exactly as you say, it's all of the above. I mean, first, it's a great honor to be given a job like that and to be allowed to walk, you know, up that tiny winding street into that slightly peculiar, very English seat of government. And it is very awe-inspiring, and it is very serious to be asked to take on a job like that and for the things that you think and for the things that you do to potentially have enormous impact in the country and the world. Beyond that, it does take you a while to figure out how to use the awesome power in the office of the prime minister. I remember a conversation with a then superior, the deputy chief of staff, Oliver Dowden, who went on to become cabinet minister and now is postmaster general. When I had an issue I needed resolved, and I brought it to him, and he said, "Daniel, I'm not going to resolve this. You are the final decision maker before the prime minister on this subject. And now that you're Number 10, you now have to take that responsibility seriously." And I thought that was an incredibly momentous conversation for me, because it really shifted me away from having been in the system, pushing stuff up, always expecting somebody a level above to make a decision. Suddenly, I was the penultimate level, and I needed to take that responsibility seriously and to make judgment calls in that role. So the job does come with all inspiring responsibilities, but also the chance to learn to make the best kind of decisions you can make.
How digital is number 10? Because as you say, it's a sort of quirky, very English house of sort of separate rooms and winding staircases. And I guess, you know, people being in there because proximity to power is as important as having a nice big office somewhere else. But how digital would you say that space is now, perhaps compared with 10 years ago?
So I think it's a lot more digital now than it used to be. You know, now people can work off their smartphones, including iPhones. They can work off various Google products and so on and so forth. I mean, when the coalition was first created, a lot of those things weren't available. But even while I was in government, we were only very slowly migrating away from BlackBerries. And I remember having won a particular victory, which meant that three of my staff in the policy unit were allowed to be given a smartphone. And it felt like, certainly today, thinking back on it, it felt like some kind of antiquated ceremony when this ancient sword was taken away from them and a new, shinier samurai sword was handed to them, but not to everybody, of course. That would have been too much. So it has changed quite a lot, even in the last couple of years. And I think the great pragmatism of the British system means that the building is at the one and same time old, quirky, with small labyrinthine corridors and pokey rooms, but it's also, you know, highly digital at the same time. And I think it's the sort of marriage of these two traditions which is the best of the British state.
What is your view of your business based in London, but operating now across a whole range of European countries? Do you think there will be an impact on the way you operate as a result of Brexit, or, you know, are you setting up independent companies in each country with a very specific sort of country focus?
So I think there's a much bigger point and a sort of series of smaller tactical points to make here. The bigger point is that Public is a European business. It's European because the co-founders are European. I'm partly Danish. My co-founder is partly Dutch. It's European because we believe the opportunity and the market is primarily European. So I think it's easier for GovTech startups that have succeeded in the UK to sell to France, Germany, Scandinavia, the Netherlands, than for them to sell to India, for example. And it's European because we are deliberately setting ourselves up as such. So we were born in London. We are headquartered in the UK, but we are a European business who have taken great pains to take investment also from important European venture investors from Germany, for example. So our entire outlook is conditioned by that. We're a European business headquartered in London. To the point about how you then operate in a post-Brexit Europe, i.e. how do we tactically deal with that? Yes, we have set up separate companies in Denmark, Germany, France that are wholly owned by our top company. Yes, it is the case if Brexit happens, which I suspect it will, we will have to go through a number of changes in the way we operate, not least because until there's a data equivalency decision by the EU, we will be running several jurisdictions with different data regimes. So we will have to find ways in which we ensure compliance across those, and that will affect a number of the things we do, not least, you know, CRM systems and where you keep the data on employees and so forth and so on. So it does affect a number of things, and in a very short-term way, of course, it affects us that the pound is as weak as it is. So, you know, it's necessitated us to think about how we move money around between businesses in order not to lose too much on the exchange rate.
Yeah, some great insight there sort of for other entrepreneurs thinking about how they operate across Europe.
And I should say, just on that, CODEC, which is the Coalition of the Digital Economy, the association that supports startups in the UK, which I sit on the board of, has worked with DCMS to put out guidance, which I recommend to anyone who's thinking, gosh, what's all this going to do for me? They've issued very useful guidance, which can be found on their website, about the kind of issues that are worth reflecting on.
Great. Well, we're always looking for good content on the podcast, so we'll get that link and we'll make sure it's on the podcast page so people listening to the podcast can click through on that and take a look. So, Daniel, now this is the Digital Leaders podcast, so I have to ask you, how important do you think it is for leaders to understand the digital world?
I think it's hugely important, and I'm very grateful for the work that Digital Leaders does, and I've been really excited to participate in some of your events. I mean, the idea that anybody can be a leader today without being a digital leader, or at least a digitally aware leader, is just a non sequitur. Everything we do, everything a leader does, whoever they are, wherever they are, in whatever sector, at whatever level, will be touched, affected by digital technologies. It may not be the main thing that they do, but it will affect the success of their business and possibly their careers. So it's hugely important that people have an opportunity to better themselves and understand some of the basics behind the digital transformation going on around us. And it's hugely important that you're made to make the sort of connections that can help you on that journey. Because not every, we know information can be disseminated in various different ways. And the sort of one-way lecture style form of dissemination that we've known from classrooms, is only one way. A kind of peer-to-peer networking set of opportunities can be hugely powerful as we try to navigate the digital world around us. So for me, creating frameworks for people to understand the digital challenges they face and to meet the sort of people who might face similar challenges or can teach them on the basis of their experiences is very valuable.
And not thinking of digital leaders specifically as an organization here, but in terms of the work you're doing, how well are we doing? Obviously you're selling the concept of GovTech into central and local government. How literate are you finding our civil servants, our local government officers?
I think it's true to say that we are still far away from where we need to be. Today, it is still possible to become a very senior civil servant and know absolutely nothing about digital or technology. In the way that most permanent secretaries will be expected to know and understand something about accounting and auditing and something about HR, that's a policy. That just is in no way the case with digital. And I think this lack of parity of capacity or capability is a real problem. And I think we need a step change in this country. I've said for a while, I think we should have a national school of government and technology. I think we need a place where the best sort of civil servants, upcoming leaders, and I should also add police officers, fire officers, local government officers, and even military officers are given the opportunity to understand the nature of new technologies and how best to engage with them. So I think we see a very variable situation. Some departments are very good, some are good in parts, some are absolutely terrible, but overall we need to step it up.
But it's challenging stuff, isn't it? Because no sooner have you got your head around the idea that digital is about behavior change and organizational structure and sort of confidence and new ways of leading, you stumble into a world of robotic process automation, AI being banded around for anything that kind of is vaguely cool, and sort of data as the new black gold. And you must feel confused, not, as a civil servant trying to work in this space. No sooner do you think you know what's happening, you're reading, you're finding out about a whole load of new things that even the people talking about them don't fully understand themselves.
But I think it's fair to say that the challenges are not dissimilar to what officials have had to deal with before. Imagine the people who were gathering around Whitehall in 1945, 5 years after the most excruciating war the continent has ever seen, after a new government had been elected, Winston Churchill famously won the war but lost the election following, and Clement Attlee became the prime minister. And can you imagine what those officials were having to do, what they were having to deal with? Fast forward to the financial crisis and Black Monday, and go beyond to 1989 and the extraordinary events in Europe that saw the unification of Germany and the collapse of the Soviet Union. And to think what the German officials had to think through as they suddenly overnight saw their country swell to almost twice the size. So I think the truth is, let's not exaggerate this, and let's not pretend that it's so different. You know, throughout our modern history, there have been these extraordinary events, and very talented officials have helped us through, led by the great political leaders. And there's no reason to think that that couldn't be replicated, but it does require us to take some steps. And those steps are, you know, we've got to be serious about the capabilities that are required, digital capabilities, data science, and so on. And that isn't just a question of what the boffins in one room or one unit or one department does, but it does require people, you know, to use the phrase you use, leaders, digital leaders, to understand better, you know, what they're dealing with.
Yeah, I agree. Very, very true. So, okay, let's finish our conversation today with our famous quickfire round of three questions. And the first one is, what one book would you recommend to our listeners and why?
So the book that I would recommend is, in fact, a book that I give to every new employee at Public. And it's a book by Viktor Frankl, who was an Austrian psychologist and who was swept up into the Second World War and ultimately ended up at Auschwitz, the death camp that the Nazis ran in Poland. And he survived and he came out of that extraordinary experience and ended up writing a book called Man's Search for Meaning. And the point that Frankl makes in the book is that the most important thing you can have in your life is a sense of meaning. You can have that come to you in lots of different ways. It can be a religious or spiritual or amorous or professional source. But ultimately, those who survived in Auschwitz, where he actually counseled people, he actually provided therapeutic services to people. His great insight is those who survived in Auschwitz and many other similar places were those who had a strong sense of meaning to their life. And so I would recommend that book. It's been one of the most important books in my life. And as I say, I give it to all employees, join Public, not because I want to compare what we do to some of the experiences that we face, but simply to say that the importance of finding a sense of meaning matters, whether it's in your life or in your business.
Excellent. So your answer may be similar, but I'm sort of thinking it may be different as well. The one person you would love to have lunch with, living or dead, and why?
So I want to answer this in two steps. The first thing is, for a long time, I really wanted to have lunch with Henry Kissinger. And for me, I was so excited when I joined the dinner and found myself sitting in front of Dr. Kissinger. So in many ways, you know, at an earlier point in my life, I actually had the opportunity to have lunch. It happened to be dinner, and there were lots of other people besides us. But it was a great honor and a real, really interesting experience. But I think I would want to have lunch with Leonardo da Vinci. And the reason for that is I've always seen myself as being interested in a lot of different things. You know, throughout my life, in particular when I was young and in school, teachers were always saying, yeah, Daniel, you would be really successful if you could just focus on one thing. And he's always interested in lots of different things. And no, the best thing for him is to focus. And then when I started out in my career, various superiors would say the same about me. Daniel, you would do really well in this job if you just focus on one thing. And I kind of realized later in life that I cannot do that. But actually, the fact that I cannot do that and the fact that I am interested in so many different things, willing to run at so many different things at the same time, is my strength. It's why Public is able to do, I think, in part, many of the things that it does, and why I've been successful in other jobs. And when I then think throughout history, who have been the sort of people who were always interested in lots of different things, lots of different disciplines. There are a couple of people who come to mind, but I think ultimately Leonardo da Vinci, the epitome of the Renaissance man, who on the one hand painted extraordinary paintings like the Mona Lisa, but also designed helicopters and tanks, and also engaged in various botanical explorations, is just the epitome of the sort of person that I would love to think that I could learn from over lunch.
Great choice. And last but not least, tell us one thing about yourself that our listeners would be surprised to find out.
That, gosh, this is a tricky one. Well, many years ago, I think I was 13, a circus came to town, literally plunked themselves on a field opposite the house where my parents lived. And I was so excited and curious that I hung around the circus to a point where they took pity on me and they offered me the chance to be a small part of a clown act if I learned to ride the one-wheeled bicycle. And so I learned to ride the one-wheeled bicycle so that I could play a tiny little role in the circus that came to town. I don't think anybody knows that. And you'll be pleased to know that it obviously wasn't so successful that I could have built a career on. But I guess that's my one secret.
Well, I think running away to join a circus is definitely one of those aspirational things that I think John Major famously ran away from the circus to become an accountant, which exactly is the exact opposite. Anyway, so gosh, sadly, Daniel, we're out of time there. So thank you so much for being on the Digital Leaders Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is it for this episode of the Digital Leaders Podcast. Now, of course, we would love to know your thoughts. Tag us at DigiLeaders and let us know. And if you want to find out more about today's guest, head on over to our website, digileaders.com/podcast, and we have all that information there. That is it for this week. I'm your host, Robin Knowles. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of the Digital Leaders Podcast.